From The Conversation, this is Politics with Michelle Grattan, a podcast where we hear from politicians and experts on the issues of the day.
Michael McCormack won the Nationals' leadership after Barnaby Joyce resigned amid the scandal surrounding his affair with his former staffer and now partner Vicky Campion. This week, the Nationals are again dogged by the Joyce fallout, with the couple, who now have a baby, selling a tell-all interview for a reported $150,000. That's overshadowed a surprising bit of good news for the party this week, the recruitment to their ranks of Tasmanian crossbench Senator Steve Martin. Michael McCormack is our guest today, and please forgive the rather echoey audio from the recording done in his office. Michael McCormack, we have to start with Barnaby Joyce. He rained on your parade this week with his TV deal. Did you ask for a please explain from him? And have you had much feedback from the electorate about this issue?
Look, I don't think he rained on the parade. He didn't attend the party room meeting when Steve Martin was welcomed in as the newest National, the first senator representing the National Party ever from Tasmania, and he made the deliberate decision not to attend the party room for that reason. So, full marks to him there. End of the day, Barnaby's made a personal choice, he and Vicky, to go down this path with the TV deal. That's a personal decision for him. And look, at the end of the day, I haven't been approached by people in my electorate or elsewhere in regional Australia, and I know the story broke at the weekend, and I've been out and about. I attended many functions on the weekend. No one raised the story with me, but what they were talking to me about were the fact that their jobs for themselves, jobs for their kids, power prices, all the sorts of things that people normally raise with me when I was out and about on the weekend, they're the sorts of issues that they wanted to talk to me about.
Why do you say it's a personal thing? That is true at one level, but it also goes to the sort of standards that MPs set and live by, don't you think?
Well, I suppose we set our own standards. We are accountable to our electorates. At the end of the day, all politics is local. And as I said yesterday, and I'll say it again right now, the court of public opinion will judge us on how they think we're performing, how they think we're delivering. Certainly, I know Barnaby has delivered for New England, but we're all accountable by our own actions and by our own words and deeds, and that's how we'll be judged, and we'll be judged at the ballot box.
Do you think that, all things considered, Barnaby Joyce will or should run at the next election?
Well, that'll be a matter for him, and that'll be a matter for the National Party in New England. That'll be a matter for a branch to nominate him, and then that'll be a matter for the branch members in New England as to whether or not they decide if he nominates or if anybody else nominates, and it becomes a pre-selection process as to who they think will best represent them going forward.
I notice you're not saying, of course, he should.
Well, again, that's an entirely a matter for Barnaby and the electors of the National Party of New England. And, you know, we saw in the seat of Ryan with Jane Prentice. Now, Jane put her hand up again, and she's been an outstanding member of Parliament, but at the grassroots level, her pre-selectors in Ryan felt as though they wanted somebody else to represent them. Now, that's democracy at work, and the Liberal and National parties don't parachute people into local electorates. They don't make it such that the executive determines who is going to represent local people. That's up to local people to decide. That's how it should be, and that's how it will be in New England.
So it's possible he won't run?
Well, anything's possible in politics.
Now, turning to the budget, how are the income tax cuts going down in the bush? What are the reactions of people in the electorates that you visit?
Well, look, a lot of the electorates I visit are framed and based on small and medium family enterprises, mum and dad businesses, many of which have been there for generations. They love the tax cuts. They love the fact that they're paying 27.5 cents in the dollar, the lowest the tax rate has been for 78 years. They love the fact that we've extended the instant asset write-off by yet another 12 months. That goes down well. But also a lot of them deal with the Coles and the big companies, the Woolies of the world, and they also acknowledge that that quite frankly, a lot of their kids, and these are the constituents I talk to, a lot of their kids work in Coles and Woolies, and we know that packing supermarket shelves is sometimes the first item on somebody's CV, on their resume. And the fact is, big business deals a lot with small and medium enterprises, and a lot of them in regional Australia producing the food items which adorn our grocery shelves. So the fact is, we are going to the next election with the 10-year enterprise tax plan and the full suite of measures that Matthias Cormann and Treasurer Scott Morrison have developed, and it's a good policy.
Now, some of the Nationals electorates, of course, are quite poor. Would people prefer, in many cases, the money spent on services than tax cuts, whether income tax cuts or company tax cuts?
Well, people also need to differentiate from when we say services. There is this misconception out there that the federal government is responsible for everything. State schools were always called state schools for that very reason, that they were funded by state governments. Public hospitals were always funded by state governments, but there's no lines of difference these days, and everybody seems to think that the federal government is responsible for everything, and we're not.
Can I just interrupt there? You are, in a sense, Malcolm Turnbull's boasting of giving a lot more money to schools, for example.
And we are, and that's because now we've got prints very much on the sticky paper, and we're spending a record amount of money in education and for public schools. Now, that's a good thing. I'm certainly, if you're a parent of a child going to school, you want the best possible start for them so that they can get a future career, etc., etc. And that is why we are funding public hospitals and public schools, and we're doing it in record amounts of money year on year going forward. But again, the fact remains they are largely the responsibility of state governments, but we're more than carrying our share of the financial burden. Financial responsibility, I should say. It's not a burden, it's actually a good thing that we are making better outcomes for health and education, particularly in regional areas.
Just to tie up on income tax cuts, do you think that people are comparing your package favourably to the Labor package, even though the Labor package gives more to lower and middle income earners in the early days, and you have this third stage of the government package, which is quite controversial because it gives to higher income.
Well, people are always saying to me that they're looking to politicians and to governments and to parliaments for long-term vision. Now, that's what we're offering. Look, I don't ever believe what Labor says. I look at what Labor has done in the past when it has been in government, and it's not a pretty sight. And people, surely they haven't got that short of memory that they fail to remember what Labor did when they were in office in 6 years federally. And Labor stands for higher taxes and therefore less jobs. And when you actually have company tax cuts across the board, you actually have the provision there and the opportunity there for more jobs, more employment. You also have the provision there for higher wages because companies do invest and reinvest in their most important resource, and that is their people, their staff.
Now, turning to another issue, I know that you personally and the Nationals generally support the continuation of the live sheep export trade, but a number of Liberals are in revolt about this, and there's considerable public feeling. Do you think this trade will continue in the longer term? And does that include the northern summer trade?
I think David Littleproud has done, no, I don't think, I know David Littleproud has done an outstanding job in what has been a very difficult period. And Australia is the only country which exports animals, which has an export supply chain assurance scheme. So from farm gate to point of destination, we have that scheme in place, that system in place, where animal welfare is number one. And certainly with the live sheep trade to the Middle East in the northern summer, we've made provisions such as the stocking density has been reduced by 28%, which gives the animals 39% more room to move about in the pens on the ship. We've also said that we will put in place and have put in place independent inspectors who will report on a daily basis to the department, to the government. And we've said we're going to look at the report prepared by Dr. Michael McCarthy in more detail to see what else we can do. But this is important. The Middle East, Kuwait and UAE and Qatar are important trading partners with Australia. Now, if we don't fill their needs and wants, some of those countries which also get chilled sheep meat, they'll stop those orders as well. And what the orders will be filled by countries which don't have animal welfare front and centre of their export.
So should
we get
into that sort of threat?
Well, at the end of the day, our farmers will miss out, and that'll mean less jobs for Australians and less export opportunities for this nation. And so it is all about the West Australian and South Australian farmers getting, and there are some Victorian and New South Wales sheep which also fill the numbers for this export trade, those farmers will miss out. And if those farmers miss out, their communities miss out and the nation suffers as a result.
On another front, a Northern Territory abattoir outside Darwin is now set to close, and the pastoralists up there are saying that they'll have to find another facility for their cull, cows and bulls. Some 200 people, I think, are employed in that abattoir. Did the Nationals look at any way of keeping this going after all the government's putting money into abattoir training abroad? What about this one on the home front?
Well, look, this is the latest in a long line of top-end abattoirs which really struggle. And these people in the leafy suburbs of Melbourne and Sydney who say, well, why don't we just process all the livestock here in Australia and then box it over to Indonesia and the Middle East and elsewhere. I mean, they're kidding themselves. They've got absolutely no idea of the challenges faced by those operators of those meat processing plants in the north.
What is the problem?
Well, there's any number of problems. First of all, it's getting the stock when they need it. Weather plays a part. The fact is, linking in with the markets plays a part, and getting just the number of workers to be able to fill the processing lines is a big, big challenge. Right across regional Australia, it's a challenge to find workers to fill positions. And I know that Steve Shobo and Mark Colt have done such a great job on the trade front. There are so many market opportunities, and at times companies in Australia, agribusiness and value-adding plants and factories are finding it difficult to keep up the demand that's been enhanced by this by these free trade agreements with China, South Korea, Japan, elsewhere, that we just can't find the workers to enable these factories to expand, to put on more processing lines.
So what is the problem in getting these workers? Is it the nature of the work?
It's also cyclical. It's also seasonal. So it's like any of these business operations where they get swamped with a whole lot of stock to process in one given period, and then they've got no work whatsoever in another period. And so it's just difficult to have employment contracts with people when you're only able to guarantee them employment for 3 or 6 months and then there's no work going forward, but then we want you back when the season resumes. It's just so difficult. But, there's so many other factors come into play that it's never, ever been easy to have meat processing plants operate viably in the north. And that's why when I say these people who sit at home and sip on their lattes and get out of bed at 11 o'clock and, walk around and count the amount of, amount of carbon in the air and, they've got their head up their backside most of the time, they don't understand the challenges faced by regional Australia, and they don't understand the challenges faced in the north. And at the end of the day, the Indonesians, like the Middle East countries, they want live animals. We're there, we can provide that opportunity, that export trade, and we can provide the animals, and we can do so with that export supply chain assurance scheme in place, such that animal welfare is placed front and centre. We're doing it well, but we're getting stymied all the way by people who've got, quite frankly, no idea, absolutely no idea, and it infuriates me.
I can feel that. You never enjoy a latte?
Oh, look, well, I'm more of a cappuccino person myself, but I don't knock anybody for having a latte, and, as long as it's provided with good dairy products from regional Australia, then that's fine.
Just broadening out on this jobs question, what do you think of suggestions that somehow we should get more migrants into the regions, perhaps specifically more of the refugee intake? Do you think that's desirable, feasible? a regional people interested in that sort of idea?
Well, when you've got control of your borders, as we have, you can actually provide humanitarian assistance to countries where there is conflict and a humanitarian crisis, just like we've done with the Yazidis. 55 families have come to Wagga Wagga, and you know they've integrated in the community. They've filled jobs that couldn't or wouldn't be filled by locals.
This is and your own electorate.
This is my own electorate in the Riverina, Wagga Wagga, the capital of southern New South Wales, in my Riverina electorate. So, you know, that's been fantastic. Now, I know the Regional Australia Institute just recently announced its The Missing Workers Report, a fantastic report, and, you know, and I commend Jack Archer and his team for putting that report out, for trying to connect the dots as far as trying to connect migrants with jobs in regional areas. In those regional areas, I have to stress, where the communities are ready, willing and able to take them, where there's the services, the health and education and certainly the mental health services available, but also bringing the migrants in as families. That's important, because if you just bring individuals, skilled or unskilled, the chances are they'll do the job, they'll leave as quick as they can. But if you bring families in, they integrate in the communities provide a safety net, the people get involved in local sport, the kids get involved with their, you know, they get friends at the school, and it's a win-win for all involved. It gives the migrants a new home, a new start, great energy, and it gives the regions, which are already vibrant, but it gives them another opportunity to give these people employment.
So how does it work in Wagga? Are there special services for these families, or do community groups adopt them?
All of that. Local community groups. We've got a fantastic refugee advocate support groups there. WAFRICA is one of them. Wagga Africa. They're a fantastic group, and we've got other support networks for people from all over the world. And it's also a very caring, compassionate community, Wagga Wagga, and I'm proud to represent it. But it's not just Wagga Wagga in the Riverina. It's also, I know, other communities in the Riverina. Leeton has also thrown open its arms to say, please come to us. Jenny Clark, the former Narrandera mayor, who's still on the council from Narrandera, rang me on Sunday to extol the virtues of getting more migrants in that fantastic community. It used to be at the heart of the Riverina, now it's in the Farrer electorate. More's the pity. I love Narrandera. It's a fantastic community, but it is welcome and open to more migrants coming there. And you know, Jenny Clark's spirit of saying please come is sort of emblematic of what the community is saying.
Now, just looking to the next election, the Nationals in 2016 ran a very different campaign to the Liberals and were very successful holding their seats by doing that.
And adding one, we added the seat of Murray, and Damien Drum came on board, and he's making a fantastic contribution.
Will this be the case again? Will you have a very distinct campaign?
Well, look, we will weigh that up at the time. We've got a great budget to sell, a great message to tell, and we are very much in unison with the Liberal Party about all the great economic blueprint that we've got in place. But at the end of the day, National Party people tend to be very grassroots. They tend to be very focused on their local communities, and all politics is local. Now, we ran a very good local campaign, but, you know, National Party members aren't just going to campaign when the 33-day election period gets called. We're out there campaigning now. We're out there turning up to events, listening to people and what they're saying, their expectations and demands and wants and needs. But we do that all the time, as a matter of course, because we're good local representatives. And whether you're the Deputy Prime Minister or whether you're a backbencher in the National Party, the expectation is that you will work hard day and night on weekends and make sure that you're listening and in tune with your community.
How much of a threat do you see Pauline Hanson being to you next time, more or less than in the past?
Well, you know, anybody who's going to take a vote from an LNP member, particularly, I suppose, in my case, a National Party member, is a threat. And I think Bill Shorten poses the greatest threat to Australia and the fabric of society that we've come to expect. I mean, even the attack on Australia Day, January 26, being a day of acknowledgement of what we've always done in the past. But there's so many things that, our way of life, our standard of living, our cost of living, they are under threat from Bill Shorten and Labor. and the Greens, and Pauline Hanson, obviously. You know, Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party represents a threat because who knows where her preferences might flow. We've seen in the recent Queensland state election that, you know, some sitting members were unseated because the preferences went to Labor, and now we've got the Anastasia Palaszczuk government back again and not doing a particularly good job. And so, you know, we need to make sure that we continue to sell our good budget message and to be in there in our local communities fighting hard for local needs and expectations.
Just specifically on Hanson, however, do you think she's peaked?
Well, that'll be a matter for the electorate. That'll be a matter for the constituents, but I think they will view what we've done and how we're doing it very favourably. Good budget, good local members, fighting hard, and with, you know, a backbencher, an assistant minister, a minister around, they have influence on government decisions and outcomes and delivery. So Pauline Hanson does not offer that.
Now, some might say that you as leader of the Nationals are likely to give the party a less distinct image than did Barnaby Joyce. Do you want to reshape the party or reposition the party in any sense? And do you see any danger in being portrayed as perhaps a bit more of a pushover for Malcolm Turnbull than Barnaby was?
Trust me, I am no pushover for anybody. And I am my own individual person. I'm not Barnaby Joyce. I'm not Warren Truss. I'm not John Anderson. I'm Michael McCormack. And I will, I think anybody who knows me knows when I cross the floor on the Murray-Darling Basin, knows that I put the interests of regional Australia and certainly those people in the Riverina first and foremost, and did it with a smile on my face, did it with a determination in my eye. They know that, you know, I come to this job very determined. I'm somebody who you would underestimate at your peril. Malcolm knows that I'm a very serious player in this political landscape in Canberra.
Have you had any blues yet?
Malcolm and I get on very well. We get on very well. But look, I've got an electorate to represent. I've got constituents in regional Australia who, you know, in some of the league tables, they don't fare very well. And I and my National Party team will be in there fighting hard for them every step of the way. Each and every waking moment of every day, we will be in there fighting for them, and I will be leading the National Party in doing just that. And if you already look at what I've been able to deliver, a Murray-Darling network of medical schools, that hasn't been achieved by others. It was achieved under my leadership and with the assistance of Bridget McKenzie, my deputy leader and Minister for Rural Health, among other things. So we've delivered that. And adding a voice for Tasmania in the National Party, the first senator that the National Party has ever had in the Apple Isle, that's been delivered by me too. And he came to the National Party because he liked what he saw in the leadership and he liked the stability of our party and he saw us as a natural fit for him. We saw him as a natural fit for us. I achieved that. No other National Party leader has been able to achieve that, I have to say. And, you know, we've tried. Look, you can put it down to a bit of good luck, but you can also put it down to a lot of good management. And I'm proud to say that Steve Martin is going to make a big contribution to our party going forward. And I'm delighted that we've now got another state into our big, happy, unified, hard-working National Party family.
Just on that, who made the first approach?
Steve came to me, and we had a series of very cordial meetings. But you know, we talked the business. We discussed how we could fit in with each other and what we could both bring to the table for each other. And no deal's done. He liked what he saw. He liked the leadership. He liked the stability of our party. He liked the fact that we're a voice for regional Australia. And he signed the dotted line. Good luck to him. And we'll put a structure in and around him now. And we will, from little things, big things grow.
Michael McCormack, thank you for talking with the conversation today.
Always a pleasure, Michelle.
And that's all for our political podcast for today. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Burlage. We'll be back again with you soon.
Our theme music is by Lee Rosevere. You can find more podcasts from The Conversation on our website at theconversation.com.